I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. In recent weeks in Tunisia and Egypt, we've heard angry mobs calling for their dictators to flee. We've seen regime change in those two countries, and we're watching now to see if Libya is next. A lot of people have been drawing comparisons to the People's Power Revolution in the Philippines, which occurred 25 years ago this week. Joining me now to look back at what happened then, as well as to look at what's going on now, is Phil Bronstein. There's no one better, as in 1986 he was a Pulitzer Prize finalist for his work covering the Philippines. At the time, he was a reporter for the San Francisco Examiner and was covering the revolution with his photographer, Kim Kamenich. I'll ask Mr. Bronstein about what it was like in the Philippines 25 years ago, what it was like being in the crucible of a revolution, the end of a dictatorship, the fleeing of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos, the rise of Corazon Aquino and her installation as president. We'll look back, too, at the assassination of Ninoy Aquino and how that event in 1983 marked the beginning of the end for Marcos and the road to EDSA, a popular name for the revolution taken from the Manila thoroughfare where millions gathered 25 years ago this week. Phil Bronstein is Executive Vice President and Editor-at-Large of the San Francisco Chronicle. His blog, Bronstein at Large, can be found on the Chronicle's website, sfgate.com. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Phil Bronstein. Good morning, Mr. Bronstein.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. When did you first go to the Philippines?
I first went the day that Benigno Aquino was assassinated. I had been covering the exile community in San Francisco in the Bay Area for a number of years, both for public television and for the San Francisco Examiner, and had been proposing that I go to the Philippines because things were clearly starting to unravel a little bit there, and I had done several interviews with Ninoy Aquino while he was in Boston when he came through San Francisco, and he invited me, as he did a bunch of other press people he knew, to come back with him. So I proposed to my editor that I go back with him, and my editor said, you know, sort of famously now, don't worry, you got plenty of time. You can go there anytime. So I got a call about 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning from him saying, no, you're the guy you know has just been shot on the tarmac, pack your bags. So that's when I went. Yeah. And I got there in time for the funeral.
And how many times between then and 25 years ago this week had you gone to the Philippines?
Well, I was there... I wouldn't even say often. I was there mostly on for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Or 4 years. And then I went to El Salvador after that. Since then, I've probably been back a half a dozen times, although I have not been back in a good probably 10 years.
Yeah. Well, what was happening there that was important for you to cover? I mean, was it the end of the Marcos regime that you could see even, I guess, in 83?
Well, I don't think anybody would claim that they anticipated the end of the regime because these days, with what's going on in Libya and elsewhere, it seems like it's obvious that people, you know, an uprising by enough people will cause the regime to fall. At that point, Marcos still seemed to have a fairly solid grip. I got very involved in the investigation of the assassination in terms of doing a lot of reporting on it. And it was clear that Marcos was still controlling the levers of power, but he was had been ill. He had various medical problems that later came to light. It was a little unclear whether it was Imelda who was kind of calling the shots, or more specifically, people like General Fabian Baer, who was the chief of staff. There are others like Eduardo Cuanco, who was a very prominent businessman, has returned today and is still a prominent businessman, but was extremely powerful during the Marcos era. So people were still, you know, the army, there was, I don't think at that point, a view that that the military would ever turn against Marcos. I think the forms of repression that he had instituted were still working, but there was a crack, and the assassination of Aquino, I think, made that crack much bigger. So it just seemed to me that things were happening. I had a lot of contacts, and it was one of those moments where you feel like you can be in a place when history changes.
And what was it like being in the country during the Marcos regime? I mean, people now, I went to the Philippines about a year ago, and as you know, Bongbong Marcos is now a senator. Imelda Marcos is in the Congress. She's a congresswoman. Cuanco is still, you know, quite powerful there. What was it like before the end of the regime? I mean, did you see human rights violations, suppressed freedoms, and the sort of the controlled press?
Constantly. Yeah. I mean, there was a more of a battle with the press. The Philippine Inquirer newspaper was starting to run a lot of stuff in opposition to Marcos. And, you know, they paid some penalties for that. Louis Beltran was the editor then, great character in Philippine history, claimed that the night of the rebellion, People's Power Rebellion, that he was sitting at his desk with two hand grenades, one in each hand, ready to blow them up, and himself if the soldiers tried to stop him from publishing. But there was, you know, Rene Sagisag was a prominent civil rights lawyer, later became an Aquino cabinet minister. He was in jail. I visited Nene Pimentel in Mindanao. He was under house arrest. We certainly witnessed numerous instances where people were killed, wounded. We ourselves were threatened many, many times. In one case, from General Venero there. So, you could clearly tell the atmosphere was a very repressed, violent, kind of spooky atmosphere.
The 25 years ago this week, this is when it all unraveled. This is when the people marched on EDSA. Where were you during this week itself?
Well, you know, I was in Manila. We were covering the campaigns. We covered the elections in February, the so-called snap elections that Aquino clearly won and Marcos claimed he won. And so I actually had a story that, I thought was a great story at the moment. I had found out from some sources of mine that some younger military officers, were going to rebel against Marcos in a variety of fashions. And I was in my hotel room writing that story when I started getting calls saying, you know, something's happening. Johnny Enrile, the defense minister, is sort of holed up with some of his guys who were in his junior office. Some of his very loyal junior officers loyal to him were the ones who were going to rebel against Marcos. And I kept saying, you know, oh, that's great, keep me posted. And in many ways, not wanting it to happen then because I had this great story that was going to run and be a big scoop. But the story was lost in history because that was the night that they holed up at the military camp, and the People's Power Rebellion started the first night of 4 days. And so, you know, I immediately went to the military outpost where Enrile and Ramos were holed up, and it was quite astonishing. People had been in the streets over a period of time because of the crooked election, so people were still out in the streets. And it just became, you know, they started coming to surround and protect Enrile and Ramos. And then, you know, then we were trying to find out what the Marcos people were doing and what their plans were and what Bear was doing and so forth.
Had Enrile and Ramos not, defected, would this have all succeeded, do you think? I mean, was that the tipping point?
Well, I think that is just generally acknowledged historically to have been the tipping point, because if you have the military on your side, and we are seeing this now in a variety of places, you know, Egypt, and we're seeing it in Libya right now, I think if you start losing the military or even a significant part of the military, then that is your lever. Sometimes it's the military that actually has all the power. It's not the president or the prime minister or the king, but I think that the military has the means. So, for instance, it's been said about Libya now, and was said about Egypt, that if Gaddafi, for instance, continues to marshal his military forces to bomb, strafe, otherwise, in a variety of ways, kill protesters, eventually you will clear the streets. Because the iconic person standing in front of the tank at Tiananmen Square, the nuns standing in front of the tanks in Manila, you know, that's a great heroic moment, but I think as a constant matter, if you're being killed, if going out there means death, you can say that you're prepared to do that all you want, but ultimately, I think, and, you know, people will come out another day, but I think ultimately you could probably hang on if you're willing to spill whatever amount of blood it takes. Marcos ordered his commanders to fire. There was a helicopter gunship that I remember descended on the camp, I think, the following morning, and everyone ran for cover because we were sure that this guy was going to fire on all of us. And instead, he landed and joined the rebellious force. So I think moments like that, and it turned out later that he ordered other military units to fire on protesters, and they had refused, and the orders had not been followed. So I think that if that had happened, you might have seen things stretch out for a longer period of time.
Did you interview the Marcoses during your time in the Philippines?
Yes, many times. Originally, he refused. I was doing a lot of stories about the money he'd stashed in the United States, and I had a businessman who handed me some tapes. A Filipino businessman in the Bay Area would hand me some tapes of phone conversations he'd had with Marcos. So we'd written some pretty inflammatory stories, and this was, again, sort of in the lead-up. This is the year before the elections, 85, and we got in a letter saying they were going to sue us from the information minister. And there were a lot of phone negotiations with them, and, you know, my position was, hey, instead of suing us, why don't you just agree to an interview? Have the president agree to an interview. And ultimately, that's what happened. I got an interview with him. This was 85. I'd been covering the country for 2 years. And they'd refused up until that point. And then the snippet of it was on state TV that night, and Imelda Marcos apparently decided she wanted her own interview. So a few days later, I got a call that she wanted to see me. And I spent, 12 hours in the palace with her, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, which is always fascinating to talk to her. And after that, I talked to them a number of times, and then I think we got the first interview after they'd arrived in Hawaii in exile.
Talk to me about them and what they were like. I mean, you mentioned that she's fascinating. When you were talking to him, did he look ill to you?
No, he didn't. I mean, he was, at this point to me, it doesn't seem very old. Yeah. I can't remember exactly how old he was at the time, late 60s, I think. During the campaign, there were times when he appeared and looked very frail and was bandaged. And, there were a lot of rumors about dialysis and so forth. But for the most part, in my conversations, and at least in 85, I think in 86 he was not looking great. There's this wonderful picture that Kim Tominich, the photographer and Pulitzer who worked with him there, took of them, him taking the oath of office the same day that Aquino took it, right after the elections. And he's, looks like he's up there on the balcony of the palace blustering and everything else, but he really looked quite, quite ill, and she had a look of profound sadness on her face. He was definitely not, and I think that this was, I think that the grip that he was losing on his country, he was someone who was extraordinarily shrewd over a period of a couple of decades in politics, extremely bright guy, really understood how to push cultural, political buttons, knew how to keep tabs on everything, and this was his strength as an autocrat. And so I think as he got weaker, and he got ill, and people were, presumably hatching their own subplots around him, I think that his health became an issue. And again, it's like the control of the military. If he wasn't 100% alert, in the way, only the way that he could be. I think that he was, you know, it was just a matter of time before it was over for him.
The you mentioned the photographer Kim Komenich, and I understand that he's in the Philippines now exhibiting the photographs he took then.
Yeah, he's flying back to the States on Friday, but he does have an exhibit over there that's, I think, open in the Ayala Museum.
Yeah. Were you guys together the whole time?
The first trip I went, Kim was not with me, and I specifically asked the second time if he could go, because he's such a great photographer, and I think there may have been one other time I went without him in that five-year period, or four-year period. I'm trying to think. I can't remember, but for the most part, we went together.
So what were the days like? Would you guys be together? Like, you'd be out reporting, and then he'd just tag along, I guess, taking photographs, right?
Well, we would go some places where we knew there were things happening or might be things happening or for specific interviews. But we also operated very well independently. You know, he would go out and look for things that would make great pictures, and I would go out and look for things that would make great stories. And if one of us had to then double back, which happened a fair amount, and we did. What we tried to do was not, you know, we didn't spend any time in the hotel pool, which is kind of the not unrealistic stereotype of a lot of bad foreign correspondents.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you were in the palace, I guess, after the Marcoses left, right?
Yes.
This is before all the people came in, right? Before.
Yes, we sort of, there was a very ugly line of kids who had been handed weapons after Marcos had left to try and stave off people, and it was pretty violent and ugly. And I managed to get, Kim was not with me at that point. I managed, he was still trying to send photos very archaically, which, you know, back in those days, you had to put them on a drum, and it took forever to read. But so I went. I'd heard someone had called me to tell me that the helicopters were taking off. So I went over there. I got past this group of kids. Got into the palace. There were a few guards there who were sort of terrified, didn't know what was going on. I talked my way past them and got into the private quarters and went through the private quarters of the Marcoses.
And what was that like? What did you see?
Well, it was, you know, pretty amazing. It was clearly a hasty exit. You know, drawers were pulled out from dressers and clothes and other items were strewn around. I, of course, looked through. At some point, Mark Feynman, who was a reporter for the Los Angeles Times in the Philippines, joined me. He got in, too, and the two of us, and then I think Lynn Newman, who was a freelancer, I think the three of us were in there alone, and we were looking through documents and found some interesting documents and saw in, walked right past the vault where Imelda had apparently had her, you know, had her jewels. She'd taken a lot, but apparently, based on what some of Cory Aquino's yellow ladies were wearing the next morning on TV, apparently she left some of them. So we didn't see those. There was a sort of a makeshift hospital operation there, clearly to tend to Marcos. It was just mostly the ambiance of this place that had held really all the power from where the power emanated for so many years, and it was just like a hurricane had gone through it, and they clearly did not have a lot of time to pack up.
And so after the Marcoses leave and Aquino becomes president, was your sense that democracy came to the Philippines? Do you think that they were well served afterwards?
Well, I think it was a political revolution, strictly. It was not a social or cultural revolution. I think, you know, you still have 70% of the population under the poverty level. You still have great disparity between haves and have-nots. You know, you've had several presidents who've been accused of great corruption. One of them went to jail, Estrada, since then. You know, you don't have an endless array of military coups, which you had for a while. You know, you have elections. I'm not sure how clean they are. I think, you know, corruption continues to be a huge problem. So I think that Cory Aquino was a pivotal figure in history. She was the right person at the right time to replace Marcos and to be the symbol of all of the frustrations of the many years of martial law. But I think ultimately she did not, and maybe wasn't capable of changing much. And then after Corey, you know, I think it was a series. It's been a series, and I don't know about Noinoi Aquino. I don't know him. I met him as a young man, very young man. Supposedly he's intent on rooting out corruption, but I think that the fundamental problems of the society remained after people power.
I'm wondering what can the Tunisians and the Egyptians and perhaps the Libyans learn from all this, do you think?
Well, I think that People's Power in the Philippines was really the first contemporary moment where people rose up and in a relatively bloodless manner got rid of a dictator. And I think that people were inspired in a lot of places. People were inspired in Burma. People were inspired in South Korea. People were inspired ultimately in Eastern Europe. So I think that it did have, at that time, a ripple effect throughout the world. In some of those cases, you know, the uprisings were successful in changing things. In some cases, they were notoriously not successful. And it's been 25 years, so I'm not sure that people, I mean, most of the people probably in Tahrir Square or in any of these other countries, whether it's Tunisia or Libya, I suspect most of the people out in the streets weren't even born in 1986. So I'm not sure that there's, you know, they owe anything to, that there's a legacy. But I think the fact that it was the first time that it happened and that it was successful probably historically created some space for this kind of thing. And we still don't know how it's going to come out.
HBO made a documentary on all this some years later, A Dangerous Life. Was the Gary Busey part based on you?
Well, the guy who did most of the screenwriting worked with me. This guy, Lynn Newman.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of moments, like Kim and I were the only ones with this guy, this wonderful, brilliant guy, Avilio Javier, Harvard-educated, young politician, huge promise, was on the Aquino side, and we spent election day with him, and then he was killed a few days later when the votes were being counted, and we'd interviewed the sort of the Marcos warlord there, who clearly had some responsibility. And then we flew back with his brother, who had gone down there to claim the body. So there were scenes in that movie that only could have been based on our experiences because no one else was down there.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can tell you. Otherwise, I have no idea.
Phil, you're really great to do this. I appreciate your time and thanks for this. Phil Bronstein is the Executive Vice President and Editor-at-Large of the San Francisco Chronicle, very kindly joining us on the line from Hawaii on vacation. The website for more, sfgate.com. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.